I'll talk a little bit about this, and then we'll get on to the topic at hand. Let me give you one of each of these. My name is Bob Lee, and I'm a forester by background. I grew up in a rural area, and then in the summers worked on the National Forest when I was going through school, and then started to work for private industry. And then graduated from forestry school at the University of California at Berkeley and worked in California on a small redwood property. And after seeing what happened to the redwoods with the timber industry there, I decided I really wanted to do something that would look at the social issues, because I didn't like what I saw. What happened to the forest, what happened to the people. So I went back to school and started to study sociology and forestry. And Yale hired a sociologist and was able to make that combination. So I've done that for almost 40 years, studying that. And I've worked also for the National Park Service as a research sociologist. And for the last 30 years, taught and did administration at the University of Washington. And I've just recently retired from there. And I'm living over in the Skagit Valley on a farm without any trees.
Oh, no.
Moved back to my wife's home country, and it's flat agricultural land. We have 40 acres of potatoes. So I'm having to plant some trees there in order to feel that I'm at home. It's okay. I planted a lot of trees at the last place, and if you know foresters, then one thing we do well is we'll plant trees, and as long as they're going, leave them and let that carry on to somebody else. That's a gift to the world. Okay, I also, over those roughly 50 years of experience with forestry and sociology, and having traveled in Asia and done sabbatical work in Japan, and traveled in Thailand and Indonesia, discovered that religion and forests are very closely linked. And that when it comes to trees, they tend to be things that people value as very powerful objects in their lives, and they attach a lot of emotion to. And you may feel that way yourself about beautiful trees, beautiful groves. I have my favorite groves in the redwoods. How many people travel through the redwoods? Never stop at the Rockefeller Grove. If you do it again, I highly recommend you seek out the Rockefeller Grove on Redwood Creek, because it's a grove in which you walk in, and there are trees that are almost 300 feet tall, and they're so dense that there's very little light that reaches the forest floor. And there's nothing but sorrel. It's like a clover-looking plant on the floor. So you get these massive trees, red trunks, logs scattered around, some young redwoods, and then just like a carpet, just very little brush, just sorrel. It's just a very, very moving place, and it's fascinating because when we enter it, my wife and I always stop and start whispering as if we're going into a cathedral. And everyone else treats it that way. It's a place you can't help but have some sense of reverence for. So we all feel that way about trees. And the question is, what happens when people don't feel that way about trees and then start feeling that way about trees? And that's what we're going to talk about today, and what happened in the 1990s in the Western U.S. and then across the whole U.S. But before I start, I just wanted to draw your attention on a little sheet. If you didn't get one, I will make sure you do. Not terribly important, but I have a statement of theology there. It's a bit literary, but I like it. It's my view of nature. And it's important that we see nature in terms of not just its beauty and how much we may love trees, but the fact that as humans, we can't live without taking from nature. Things have to be, we have to kill things in order to survive. And that's something we don't like to talk about. And so how do we, as Christians, then build that into our thinking and feelings so that it's okay to treat nature, yes, with tenderness, but knowing well that we can't live without taking from life. And this is a little poetic, almost poetic statement about that. And in the sessions that I'm leading here what I'm doing is struggling with that issue. And next week, I'll be struggling with it a lot more directly. Today is really a little piece of interesting history. And then Monday, I'll have an introductory session on forestry and talk about the relationship to the sacred religion. And then Tuesday, I'll be leading a tree walk, for those of you who will be around next week, a tree walk on the 10-mile trail, and we'll be looking at trees and forest ecology. And then the next will be talking about the romance of trees and how a Christian might approach the romance of trees, because that may misplace a certain sense of the what we really might think about as Christians, and how can we recover a relationship to nature that is not just governed by romance, feeling that nature is, you know, gives us this passionate feeling, and yet what that does is stand in the way of our own rational and pragmatic problems of taking from nature in order to live. And then I wrap up on next Friday with a session that will deal with the greening of the church and some of the issues around greening congregations and what St. Paul will tell us about some of that. He didn't talk about greening the church, obviously, but something that we can draw from Paul on that. And then if you have little kids, I'll be leading a nature walk for kids where we'll collect samples of trees and talk about the mystery of trees. Fun thing for kids. Okay. What we want to do today is to look and see what happened with the Northwest Forest during the 1990s. And I wasn't prepared to talk about all of this when I left home, so I left home my tables of data. And so, well, it's important that you understand the forests of the Northwest, where they are, or who owns them. So I'll give you that background very roughly. These are not real numbers, so you don't need to write them down. They're rough approximations. And look, if you look at the mountains of the Northwest, the Cascade Range, which we are on the east side of here, that runs all the way down to Southern California, and about a third of the way into California becomes the Sierras. So there's this rib of mountain range that the continental plates have shifted and driven up this huge ridge all the way along the rib of the Pacific coast. And that ridge is covered with forests. Most of those forests are national forests. They belong to the federal government, and they're administered by the U.S. Forest Service, which is lodged in the Department of Interior, Department of Agriculture. So a little bit odd, agriculture administers forests. And then there are a lot of lands outside that were poorer lands that didn't get reserved early, and those lands are managed by a unit of the Department of the Interior, which is the Bureau of Land Management. So a lot of the intermountain grasslands, brushlands, if you've driven here from the east, you've gone through those. A lot of that land that nobody wanted when the lands of the west were settled ended up held by the government and managed by the government, and that was Bureau of Land Management. So let's look at this, primarily at this ridge of forest that runs along the Pacific coast, and then closer to the coast, you also get a smaller coast range. It's quite pronounced in Washington on the Olympic Mountains that are on the other side of Puget Sound, right along the coast. And then that coast range continues on again through down through the middle of California. And so if you have forests along that smaller coast range, along the main rib, in Oregon, half of the land is owned by the federal government, the forest land owned by the federal government. And about 35% by the private individuals. That tends to be on the low ones. On the mountains regions, you're getting federal ownership. In Washington, only about 25% of the forest land is owned by the federal government. Either, and when I say federal government, it's the Bureau of Land Management or the U.S. Forest Service, and quite a bit more private. And the same thing for California, but I've been considered only Northern California. This may be a little low, my guess. probably about 40%, or approximately 40% of the forests of Northern California the federal.
Would the private be held by like Weyerhaeuser and other such companies?
Both big companies as well as small individual tree farms, or people who just hold, you know, 30, 40, 50 acres, have a house on it, may manage it, may not. So we've got this, if you look at the map, this nice green stripe that runs down that whole big ridge and then along the coast of the smaller one. Well, a lot of those forests were never cut. And up until 1940, almost none of them were cut if they were on the federal land. So after World War II, the federal government decided they should go into a far more aggressive plan of putting roads into those mountainous forests, cutting the trees, and turning those into very productive tree farms. So they could grow wood. So it meant a lot of clear cutting and road building and reforestation so that there'd be a long-term supply, continuous, sustained supply of wood off the federal forests. And that took place on this federal land in the mountains. And then, of course, people could drive these roads, get up there and go camping and hunting and berry gathering and wood gathering. And so they began to see what was going on, and pretty soon the public said, hey, there's way too much road building. Too many clear cuts, too much road building, that's the public's land, we'd like less. And then the environmental community began to say, all those old forests out there, there are still millions and millions of acres of old forests that have never been cut. They said, those need to be saved. Those should be saved because the old growth, as it was called. Old growth is a term we're going to talk about today. Old growth forests. Never been harvested before on that federal land, should be saved. And on the private land, those had been cut out a long time ago because it was on generally lowlands where it was easier to get at, and they built railroads in by the 1940s, and most of that had been cut. And now they're working on the third cutting of a lot of that private land. So what happened in the 1990s was that the environmental community had organized itself very successfully to find a species that lived on all these old lands, old forests, and that was the spotted owl. And so the science was developed that claimed that spotted owls required old growth forests, and therefore we had to save the old growth forests, and under federal law, any species that would be endangered would have to be protected under the Endangered Species Act. So there were a series of injunctions that were issued by the courts saying you have to stop harvesting on, or at least have to stop making timber sales on these old forests. And a terrible battle ensued, and the timber industry and the people who depended on logging and sawmilling and local counties that depended on the revenue from that literally went head to head with the environmental community. And it got to be such a controversy that when Bill Clinton ran for president, he visited the Northwest and he promised that he would address the issue. George Bush Sr., when he was president, looked at it and decided the easiest thing to do was to run the other way, which he did. As he said, this is the last of my term, I'm not going to take this one on. So Bill took it on, head on, and said, we will have a forest conference. Bring everybody together around one table after I'm president, I promise. And that's what we'll be talking about today. And why that was so important was that these court injunctions had reduced the harvest of timber on those lands to the point where it had dropped to about 5% of the harvest that had happened historically. There were about 4.6 billion board feet harvested annually on these federal forests. Huge amount of timber, softwood timber. Went into homes, primarily
timber for construction of homes, 2x4s, 2x6s, 2x8s, big 6x6 beams, that sort of thing. And so when that was withdrawn from sale, then of course all these little communities that depended on that were in financial trouble, enormous displacement of employment, a lot of problems that resulted in people's individual lives and in the communities. And this, of course, added to the stress. So Clinton came along about the time where that stress was building. And so what's most interesting about this problem is that up until about mid-1980s, these old forests out there that were not already protected in wilderness or in national parks, and a part of this other out here would be national parks, like right up here we've got North Cascades National Park, which protects a lot of high elevation forests and old forests. And then we've got Rainier National Park, and then down the chain we've got Crater Lake and Lass and Yosemite and so forth. And over on the Peninsula Olympic National Park, park. So trees were protected in all those places, but the old trees that were not in designated wilderness, as surrounds us here, that were still open to harvesting, were seen as commodities. So most people thought, well, they're old trees, and the trees that are up on these steep, high mountains are not always the biggest trees, so a lot of people thought, well, what's so special about them? They're not like the great big trees I see over in Olympic National Park, the spruce trees. They're as big around as this fireplace. What's so special? And people began to say, because they've never been touched by humans, they're very, very special. And they should never be touched. This is old growth. And so they were redefined from one category of our thinking, commodities, things that could enter the market and become wood, to things that were so special they should never be cut, sacred things, in the language of sociology. So I'm going to draw a little bit on my sociology half here and say these things went from being commodities to sacred things. And on the sociology half of my research, where most of my research was, this was a bonanza. What a wonderful event to study. Because other people had studied other kinds of things and that have gone from one category to another. Russian icons, sacred objects, the very image that leads one into relationship with Mary, with Jesus, with saints, become commodities for status acquisition when you buy these things on the secondary market and put them on your wall. Most people in the U.S. don't see these icons as icons. They don't. It's not a daily practice of kissing them and making some kind of acknowledgement of the sacred realities that lie behind the window through which they see those realities in that icon. So these icons become commodities, and they get valued in the market, the prices. Similarly, Afghan prayer rugs. Carry these rugs around and Muslims pray. These become, art objects, commodities, and lose their sacred character when they're acquired and sold in the markets in our society. In 19th century England, people who were poor would insure their children. A lot of child labor, but a lot of people would insure their children and then murder them. These were commodities. Kids were commodities. I mean, if they weren't put to work in child labor, they'd be put to work. I mean, they'd be put to death for the insurance receipts.
They did that with politicians too.
Yeah, I mean, probably did. So there was a movement there of a child treated as a commodity into a, as we know today, over time, historically, we treat children as sacred objects. That is just beyond our imagination that anybody would do that. So they were children over time were moved from a commodity status to a sacred status. Well, here we have trees that moved from a
a commodity status to a sacred status. So as a sociologist, I get all excited about this. This is great stuff. Okay, why? Why did this happen? And it's so sudden and so dramatic. It happened within a very few years where the general public switched in their feeling about these trees. Not all of you, it's looking like 100% of the people switched. But it was so dramatic that politicians had to take this very seriously and make a decision to support the reservation of almost all the forests on these lands, to take that off the market and to impose enormous cost on business people, small communities, workers, in order to protect the integrity of those old forests. So that's the big question. Why did that happen? And old growth trees became symbols. It's the same tree out there as it was before. What's a symbol?
Eternity, I guess.
Well, yeah, that's what they might stand for. What's a symbol, first of all?
It represents...
represents something else. So the cross represents...
Jesus.
Jesus' crucifixion. The flag represents...
patriotism.
The U.S. flag. American flag represents the nation. And what do these old growth trees represent? You say eternity.
The wilderness.
Wilderness, wildness. Untouched by humans. Okay.
So humans are unclean and everything untouched by humans is clean.
Or at least it's got some kind of special status to it. We don't want to touch it. We don't want to disturb it. Because what we do is
destroy.
Kind of defilement.
The human touch defiles it.
Defiles it. So these old growth forests became symbols. They were symbols before, perhaps to some people they represented money. But this is in terms of a society, this is a dramatic transformation. I mean, absolutely dramatic, and it was wrenching change for the Pacific Northwest. The rest of the nation was, affected very little by it. But in this region, it was gut-wrenching, absolutely gut-wrenching, and whole families were torn up, communities torn up as a result of this. So, I could take you on a very interesting journey, but I'm not going to do it. I could teach you sociology,
okay?
And we could go through lots of technical language of the fathers of sociology, Neil Durkheim, and their definitions of the sacred and all that, which is in the book I'm writing on this, which is on how trees became sacred. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to give you a very simple version. In terms of sociological theory, I'll give you just a few sentences of that. Things become sacred in a society when there is a ritual. We have our rituals and our religious practices. A ritual, a collective social ritual that concentrates emotional energy on something so that everybody's attention is drawn to it. And they all sense there's something very important there, if not powerful there. So if these things switched so rapidly, there had to be a social ritual of some sort that took place that concentrated that kind of attention. And out of that attention, then these objects, these commodities, would be reborn, if you will, as powerful symbolic objects standing for eternity, the wild, and so forth. And it's a fascinating historical transition. Now, Bill Clinton, my opinion, is a political genius. He was. I'm not sure he's been terribly much of a genius lately when I watched him, but it's my opinion. But as president, he was absolutely astute. And not since 1905 had a president placed such attention on forests, and it was Teddy Roosevelt who helped found the whole national forest system and actually traveled to places in the West with the father of American forestry, Gifford Pinchot, and used his influence to set aside these lands as national forests 100 years ago. Not since then had a president said he was going to give that kind of attention to a forest problem. So here is the President of the United States, newly elected to office, coming to the West and having a forest conference in April of 1993. Not been inaugurated very long, and he comes to Portland, and he has this conference, and you imagine, you know, national television, international press, enormous event, focused on one thing, old growth forests. Talk about a collective ritual and emotional energy packed into that. So what I'm going to do is show you a piece of a film called Forest Wars, which was an attempt to find the middle ground of all this and represent all the perspectives. And then we're going to look at that and we're going to talk about, okay, in this film, what kind of emotions exist in the various people that are there, and what did they represent, and particularly what did they represent that may tell us about the religious sentiments of people or their emotional feelings, and then where the ultimate decision goes, we can talk about that, and then we'll also talk about the history, where it went from there. So, I can find my way through all the technology here. And I will narrate some of the characters.
It's more than trees. It is openings and young sapling stands and medium-aged trees. But many of us have only imagined one kind of forest.
You know, my perception has always been that when the Europeans first arrived here, that this is what all the forests look like.
Actually, old growth is just the endpoint of a successional process. And as a result, it was always just a small part of the landscape. It never dominated the landscape in North America. In fact, without the other ages of trees in the forest, we wouldn't have old growth.
In the forest wars, the words old growth or ancient forest have become fighting words. This is because of the confusion about what they mean.
Recognizing the importance of our old growth forests, a part of our national heritage that if once destroyed, will be gone forever for every generation that follows.
How can we preserve our precious old growth forests, which are part of our national heritage and that once destroyed, can never be replaced?
You're going to hear a lot about old growth today.
As a blogger.
And I'd like us to keep it in the perspective that trees are like people, it just grows and it gets older every day. They're like you and I. You're going to be old growth one day, Mr. President.
Well, what is old growth? I suppose it's what the judge told the Forest Service they couldn't cut.
Who was going to define it? The good guys or the bad guys? The people that wanted it to live or the people that wanted it to fall down and get on log trucks?
Old growth depends on who's different. It seems to be anything that the environmentalists don't want you to log.
I think of Justice Potter Stewart when he talks of pornography. He said he couldn't define it, but he knew it when he saw it.
Something that's just been there from the beginning, and man hasn't messed with it, and they don't want him to touch it.
I heard a guy say once that saving old growth was like trying to save a banana, just on a different time frame.
What's an old growth? I don't know. Old growth means a big tree. Since they could, that's right.
Old trees, especially giant ones, capture the imagination. Chad Oliver is in a forest that is the result of a fire that burned nearly 200 years ago.
Because of its beauty and the condition of it, we've very often ascribed a lot of human values to it that fit with our original ecological theories of this forest. You see, we originally believed that this forest was some kind of a pristine condition that existed in a steady state, and that the forests left to themselves would grow to this condition and then maintain this stable condition.
We know a lot more now. We know that the forest is constantly changing.
Despite the violent forces in nature, most of us believe that humans are the most destructive. As a result, we set large tracts of land aside in national parks or wilderness, hoping that we might protect these areas from ourselves.
We're standing at the gate to Yellowstone National Park, and many people who drive through this gate think that they're entering a different world, a natural world, that they're going into the past. And to me, this isn't a barrier between the human world and the natural world. To me, this is a philosophical, symbolic barrier that represents an idea on one side and a different idea on this side. On that side, the idea is simple. Humans are not part of nature. We don't belong here. We're aliens. We can look, but we can't touch, and we certainly can't manage.
However, humans have been a part of this wilderness for thousands of years. Where tribes of hunter-gatherers once roamed these valleys looking for food, Yellowstone is now visited by tourist tribes looking for Kodak moments. What has been discovered in parks like Yellowstone is that the ecosystems we protect do not restore themselves. They simply go on changing. In 1988, wildfires tore through Yellowstone, burning nearly half of the park. What was most shocking was that the fires were a direct result of protecting the forest.
Historically, small fires would have burned throughout this park in scattered locations, creating patches of young pine to replace the old pine that was lost from the fires. But what happened in 1988 was a massive fire that created one huge patch that covers nearly half the national park. And so, to me, the real problem is not the fire of 1988. The problem is the fire that we're going to have perhaps 150, maybe 200 years from now.
Okay. The fellow just talked was my first graduate student. I'm so proud of him. So there's different voices that we hear there, the people talking about old growth, and that film attempted to provide a balance. I think it probably had a point of view, but the voices you heard were fairly well distributed across the spectrum. But the two scientists were represented, the last person who spoke, and Chet Oliver with the sweater, are forestry professors. So some people would say, well, there's some bias there because they represent a forestry profession, and that's not as the same thing as having biologists do it. So in fairness, I should say that in terms of competing points of view, from a forestry perspective, it's very balanced. From a political perspective, it probably leans more toward the idea these forests are constantly changing. And one of the big problems we face is the fact that trees, old trees, tend to be symbolic of permanence, and that they've been there forever. And you heard that from one of the voices. So in looking at this symbol of old growth, a lot of people feel that these big trees are really important because they are rooted in the earth deeply. They stand in the face of all kinds of storms over hundreds of years and are robust. They're so tall, they reach the heavens, they live longer than we do. So they become symbolic of a strength and permanence that we can put our trust in, if you will. And some people will say, you know, trees never die. Well, from this, you know, you obviously see that trees do die, and forests do go through these stages, and what's old growth today will burn or be blown down a windstorm or blown up by a volcano and be replaced by young trees. And then historically, these patches would be distributed across the landscape. In pre-European times, distributed across the landscapes, you'd always have old forests some places and young forest others. But one place could never remain old growth forever, because Douglas fir trees live maybe 500 years on the average at the most. And we take a walk on Tuesday, we'll see that they're about 250 years here and they're starting to break up and fall down. And if we left this to nature, these trees would burn and be replaced by young trees. So I don't know if that gives you enough facts on forestry to sort of begin to tie into the fact that trees have become so important in an emotional sense in our society, and they then have come to represent this sense of permanence, wildness, eternity, and connection of the humans with something much larger. And that's where the religious sense comes in, is what people refer to as the spiritual power of trees. spiritual power of trees. So where does this power come from? Yeah.
Well, for me, I'm remembering growing up in the 70s, and I'm remembering suburbs and a lot of trees being used in kind of these boring subdivisions, and I remember kind of the hippie movement embracing a move away from that, back to nature. Right away, my mind went to tree huggers, and there was a natural a moving away from a society that was too removed from nature, perhaps.
Okay.
So it was a shift back toward nature. That's what I think of when I think about this, because I was a young adult during that era.
I mean, if you think about that time, I mean, young people or others could have gone back to the land, and some did, and get a piece of land and start growing crops on it, get back to nature by going to gardening and farming and raising rabbits or whatever. That's one way of going back to nature, but what happened for most people?
They lived in cities.
They built a house.
They built a house, and at the same time they...
killed a car.
Pardon?
They drove a car.
Drove a car. At the same time they...
revered the forest.
Revered the forest.
But they cut everything down to build the house.
But they had some trees somewhere had to be cut down to build a house. But they didn't want to think about that, right?
Here, and here in this place, which is partly at least a celebration of God's glory revealed in nature and the forest, we have this building that shows off bare wood.
Yeah, this is a beautiful structure, and yet what do we celebrate? We're celebrating manufactured wood. It's beautiful. It's comforting. Right?
And trees have to die to make it happen.
Right. So this is one of the interesting contradictions in our culture. Is that there are certain things we don't like to talk about in our life. It used to be sex, and unfortunately, in my opinion, in many ways, we've got too much sex talk today in society. But there are other things that are taboo today. It used to be sex was taboo, and now talking about how we change nature in order to live is a very taboo topic for a lot of folks. They don't want to hear about it.
Along with things like where meat comes from.
Yeah. Where did we get, people didn't stop building houses when we set aside, when we withdrew 4.6 billion board feet of timber off of, annually harvested off of national forests. Where did we get wood?
Canada.
New Zealand. One forester went down to New Zealand and went into a forestry office down there, and there was a little mantle in an office, and there was a spotted owl on it. And they asked, what do you have a spotted owl for? Well, we worship that. Why do you worship? Well, we have 15% more return on our sales now than we had before. We didn't have to do a thing. So it was a restriction in supply. What happens when economics, when you restrict the supply, the price goes up. So Weyerhaeuser Company, the Canadians, and even as far away as New Zealand, enjoyed this massive windfall profit. So we got our wood. We continue to build our houses. It just came from somewhere else. And if you drive up to British Columbia, and you see the big clear cuts up there, you know where it came from.
How much came from there, from Brazil?
Not much out of Brazil. Brazil probably has pulpwood. That's where, increasingly, we've exported our pulping industry in places like Brazil, and we grow fast-growing eucalyptus or pine in the tropics. And in fact, the U.S. is probably over time moving out of the pulp business, pulp because of the environmental restrictions. It's a fairly, in some ways, a very expensive, dirty industry, and it's a lot more efficient to park those pulp mills somewhere else, offshore. And so that's been a globalization of that industry.
So to keep from despoiling our wild places, we're hiring other people to despoil theirs.
Yeah.
But it's something we don't want to talk about.
Okay.
outsource.
I guess the same argument goes for our oil problem, too.
Yeah, we, I don't want to get too far into politics, because I'll take us into politics right away, but you can make those connections about what we do internationally as a nation in order to secure our oil streams.
Well, it's my observation that a lot of the people that revere the wilderness and the old growth forest and they, whatever it symbolizes for them, have never been there. And so it's a mythical idea in their minds that they feel this has to be protected, and there's no practicality involved with it at all.
Yeah, well, that's one of the opinions, and I think that was represented on the tape. And so the real question we get to, if these trees have come to have a sense of power, and I think we've all acknowledged in here, at least whether we agree with that or not, I mean, you just acknowledged it, that it's a mythical state, sense of power that people may hold. If the trees have a sense of power, is it sacred? Are these trees sacred?
I think most of the problems we face in the world don't come in, you know, one thing we have to avoid and stay as far away from it as possible. Most of the problems we face in the world today are better pictured as two ditches we have to avoid both of. And the one ditch is regarding all of the wilderness as strictly an economic commodity to be maximized. And the other is this attribute a false sacredness to it, which doesn't come from any Christian tradition.
Okay, you're saying if it is treated as sacred.
I mean, we need to manage it sustainably.
Yeah.
Okay. Treating it as sacred doesn't, the Bible doesn't say forests are sacred.
Yeah. Well, that's the question for us, because if there are a lot of people in our society who say these forests have a special power, and in fact, some of those people would say that the Christian tradition has been instrumental in the harvesting of those forests, multiply and subdue the earth, and that gets quoted all the time in certain circles. So you get this conflict, and that's why I say that forestry and religion are very close, because some people will say that Christianity has not been good because it has led to exploitation of nature in the subdue and multiply quote. Now, the scholarship on that I've looked at, and it's I don't want to support that claim in any way. It's an opinion. Yes.
Maybe the movement grew out of a mismanagement of our forests. You know, the pendulum swung
right, so
far that it had to swing back, and it swung back too far. And maybe it's a matter of a new era. Maybe it's time for, you know, you're talking about 93. That's old. History. You know, maybe it's time for a new education. Like, I never heard anybody say that old forests, there's old growth generated. I mean, obviously I knew that, but
right,
I never thought about it that way before. That's just a simple education thing that, oh, here's wonderful old growth, and over here's middle-aged growth, and over here's young. And if people knew that it was going to be managed so that some of it would grow to old growth, then maybe people will go, well, sure,
yeah,
let it go. Let
okay.
go of the...
Would that be satisfactory? You think that would be satisfactory? You think people would attend the
Education sense? Works when people are being rational.
Okay.
And your point is well taken, that as a nation we've decided that these things are sacred. And so it's not a rational issue anymore. It's got too much emotional baggage on it.
Yeah. Well, if we look at two words, sacred and holy.
Uh-huh.
Sacred meaning that it draws you to God. Holy is for God exclusively. And I do believe that the Bible describes creation as something that draws you to God. So if we can define sacred in that way, I think it is a positive term.
Okay, so you're saying these trees with their power draw us to a relationship to God.
If we're looking at it in a Christian map, yes.
Okay.
In Romans where it says that man is without excuse, because
that's one, I mean, there's a lot of
God is manifest in his creation.
Okay, the real dilemma here that created, now let's take another point first, or was it the same point you were going to make in back?
Well, I'm probably on a different track a little bit.
Let's take this track and I'll come back to you then.
Yeah.
Because it sets up a dilemma, because if in fact the power of old trees leads us to a relationship with God, and then we find that we have to cut those trees, or those trees burn down in a wildfire, or they are destroyed in a windstorm, or blown down by a volcano, how do we deal with that?
That's different than being logged.
Okay.
That's different than a chainsaw. That's an act of God / nature.
There's a story of the 10 talents. You remember the landlord gave so much money to his servants to go invest it. He came back, and all the ones were rewarded were the ones that had invested the money. The one servant who went and put that talent and buried it so it would be safe and he could give it back was the one that was fired. And now I consider setting the forest aside to be a serious mismanagement of the resources that have been given to us.
I would disagree. So this is good, man. And continually, you know, through our mismanagement, I mean, look what we've done to our rivers and streams and everything else with the mudslides and all the other garbage that happens. I think that this is just a way of, you know, protecting something that is truly sacred. When you can go into like the Olympic National Forest and, you know, yeah, maybe you hear an airplane, but it's peacefully quiet and you're truly at nature, it's a true escape from the, you know, the world that we've created with all the busyness and noise and confusion at times that exists in our lives.
Back here. Good point. Yeah.
I think we're getting a little off track, because as we were very much a part of this movement as involved in environmental things. In fact, we're probably the only people in this room who have actually filed an appeal for a timber cutting permit, and we won. So that's the first thing I would say, is that there was within the environmental movement a huge grassroots movement, and that was driven in part by some of the large environmental organizations such as the Audubon Society, the Sierra Club, who saw that they could use the forest practices law, and they actually went out and trained us. We went to a training session on how to appeal a timber sale.
Okay.
Nuts and bolts. This is what you do. This is the law. You challenge this, and this, and this. So there was this huge grassroots movement that basically gave us the tools to do these exactly these kind of things. Then there was the Endangered Species Act.
Right.
And that had become interpreted in various and sundry laws so that we could use that very effectively.
Right.
And that of course is the spotted owl that was very much tied to the old growth forest. It carried a lot of baggage.
Right.
One was the spotted owl, another was one that was tied in exactly at the time that Clinton had his meeting in Portland, and that was the issue of water quality and salmon.
Right.
And so for the Northwest, it very quickly got tied in to what we knew was going to happen for a long time, and that was that we were going to start seeing a decrease in the salmon runs. So those of us who are very interested in salmon and water quality issues as well hooked our wagons to the old growth ones as well, saying, but we're not just talking about old growth, not just about spotted owls, but we're also talking about water quality and salmon. So a lot of things came together at one time to produce this major shift.
Okay, good. Glad you said that. And then back here, then up here, then I'm going to have a comment.
Well, part of it's time scale, too. I mean, if you go in and clear cut a forest, it's going to take, you know, 100 years, even longer, to get back to the state it was in before. And, you know, logging practices have improved. But, you know, my lifetime, if I have a forest that I hike in and spend, you know, I spend probably, you know, I don't know, probably 20 hours, well, probably 10 hours a week out in the forest. I live in Flagstaff, and it's right there. But, you know, if you go in and clear cut that forest, it will never be the same in my lifetime.
Right.
And
they don't plant it with the same trees.
you know, that's where the difference is. And the other part is economics. How much does it cost for the Forest Service to prepare a forest to be harvested? They're actually spending more money than they were getting back into the timber sales.
In some places.
In some places.
In this region where we're talking about here, it really floated the rest of the nation, because here there was a positive return.
Yeah, but in a lot of places.
In other places, you're quite right. Your mountain region.
In many places, there was a negative return. Down
your
home, ridiculous.
Down your way, it was. It was a net loss.
And my other question is, how much of our wood does come from commercial plantations from private land?
At the moment, we're a net importer of wood in the United States. So we grow far more wood in the forest than we're actually harvesting, and we import about 28%. Last time I looked, 28% of our softwood is imported from other countries. So one point up here, then
I guess my perception on all this is that to try to keep the big picture in mind, and I think you alluded to it at the beginning, Bob, is that, you know, we're stewards of all this, and all of it, not just the big trees, but all of the fish and the water and the quality, and finding a way to, I think the Indians did a better job of respecting what we've been given as a gift, not that we shouldn't use it, but that we
that's a good point.
And the other littler point I want to make is that I think trees give us more than wood.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of air quality and
shade. I said that with an undergraduate class, and within 10 minutes we had 75 different contributions that trees make to our life, mm-hmm. beyond wood. I mean, it's just enormous. And yet the problem is, there are a lot of humans in this world, and we want a lot of things, and we need a lot of things too. Where do we get it? And I'm just going to pose a dilemma here for you in terms of this, because it's something we will struggle with as Christians. So how do we deal with this? That we, to live, have to take from nature, and if what we have in nature that we want to take from, we have considered sacred and untouchable, what do? Do we import it from Canada? And what happens? This is the dilemma. What happens? Okay, we know that we're running out of energy in this country. Oil is not going to go on forever. And in fact, we've probably reached peak oil production in the world. We have it for another 50 years, but it's going to become progressively more expensive, and there'll be little blips where it'll be less expensive, and then it'll go up and be more expensive. Over time, it's going to cycle up and down and get ever more expensive. Unless we come up with another source of energy, fusion power or some other magical discovery at this point, we're going to be turning to bioenergy, solar, wind, wave power, all kinds of things. What's one of the cheapest and most accessible forms of bioenergy?
Wood.
Wood. And when the general public learns that we have vast national forests that are burning up every summer that could be harvested, what are they going to say?
Harvest them.
They're going to say, manage them for energy. The fascinating thing is, you can convert cellulose to alcohol far cheaper than you can convert corn. And that's going to be a huge dilemma for us.
So we'll look at the forest fires burning and say, why don't we burn that for usable fuel rather than...
Exactly the question that's going to come about. And so, well, today in forestry schools, my place I just retired from, the University of Washington, did away with its undergraduate degree in forestry, because the feeling was that we're really moving into a new era where we're not going to be as intensively managing a lot of our forests, and the industry can prepare their own people. Well, my point, and I was on the losing side of a pretty bloody argument, is wait 20 years, and we'll have to reinvent professional forestry education all over again, because we have to act then as responsible stewards of forests that we're going to have to move in and actively manage, and we're going to have to do a much better job than it was ever done historically. And if that, for those of us who want to bring in a strong, an ethic that's grounded, the Christian tradition is going to give us a lot to help sort that out, so that your question gets answered. How do we do it? and respect all these different functions of trees, protect the salmon, protect the different species that live there, and at the same time take out something that we could use. That's our big dilemma. And the sacred tree may be a very, very temporary state of our society. If you look at this, what's fun about sociology, why I got so excited about this was, is these objects switch from commodities to sacred objects very quickly, back and forth throughout history.
And do we worship the creation more than we worship the creator?
Do we worship the creation more than the creator? And at what point then do we not just go out and, you know, exploit it, but actually move in with an ethic that will govern it? And that's the challenge that we'll all have as a Christian community, is what do we have to contribute to that dialogue? One last thing, and then we got to go to Vespers.
But that's a huge paradigm shift too, because the Christian church 100 years ago said it's our dominion, it's our right to come in and clear the land and do what we want to do, because we're human beings just like God.
Well, the Christian church deforested Northern Europe, if you look at it.
Well, and they still are. I mean, there's quite a bit of controversy over the involvement in the Church of Christ with Weyerhaeuser and selling off huge plots of land up in Canada that were then turned around and, I mean, the guys who acquisitions through the Native Americans and, you know, there's a lot of controversy up there right now about what the church sold off to Weyerhaeuser for next to nothing that wasn't theirs in the first place. So the church, suddenly now we see ourselves as stewards of the land. And that's really only about three generations old. Before that, we were seen as given this right to do whatever we wanted with it.
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. And that's where that reflection is needed, because there is no existing paradigm that's going to do this for us. There's no way of thinking that's going to help us. We can't go back to an earlier period and say, well, back in the early part of the century, the foresters had the right answer. No, they didn't face our problems. We have to come up with something new. We have to struggle and figure out what that is, because it has to meet the demands that people have made for species protection, water quality, salmon, and so forth, things we didn't even know about 50 years ago.
But I think Holden's trying to model that in some way, that, you know, we reuse whatever we can.
Okay, one pitch, then we're going to go to Vespers. Anyone here who hasn't done it, I highly recommend you volunteer for Garbology, because if you want a lesson, we're talking about this at dinner. If you want a lesson in ecological relationships, see what we throw out here and what we take home with us. And I did that yesterday as part of my staff responsibility. Teaching staff has to volunteer on these things too. And it was great. Great lesson. Made my wife do it today too.
Mm-hmm. Sign up quick. Spots are going fast.
Off to Vespers.